You ready? Patrick?
Yeah, I'm just gonna.
Welcome, everyone, to the first 2012 meeting of the Senate Committee on Business, Transportation, and Economic Development. I'm short a couple of members, so we can't take any action, but we're going to start out with opening some hearings to get people moving. And then there's my fourth member. Actually, we will start out with the adoption of committee rules, since we now have a quorum. Excuse me. We do. You too. The committee rules are pretty standard stuff, members. It's the same thing we've operated under before. So we're on a go. So to get the process moving, the chair would move adoption of the committee rules as you have in front of you. Discussion on the motion. Is there any objections to the motion? The rules are adopted. We'll now open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1558. And Patrick?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 1558 modifies the scope of cost of certain economic development projects that the Oregon Business Development Department may finance with proceeds from certain revenue bonds. The measure has an emergency clause that would take effect upon passage. It has a subsequent referral to the Senate Committee on Finance and Revenue. And we have received this afternoon, and you've been sent electronically, I believe, the no fiscal impact statement, and we have in hand what is generally referred to as the revenue light impact statement, which means that the legislative revenue office will complete its revenue impact statement once the revenue committee takes the measure up, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Senator Telford, did you want to comment on this one?
Oh, most definitely. Thank you, Chairman Beyer and members of the committee. I'm Senator Chris Telford, District 27, also known as Sunny Central Oregon. Thank you for the opportunity to testify and your willingness to hear this bill. You know, one of the things I think that Oregon really needs to be looking at and is pursuing is creation of jobs and putting Oregonians back to work. This bill is another tool in the toolbox of economic development. It came to me, the catalyst was a company that is looking at moving to Oregon. They would like to move to Oregon, possibly. We are in competition with other states. And but they would like us to be more competitive with these other states. These other states allow industrial revenue bonds, which are taxable bonds, no state money involved, private money. And what our current law says is that industrial revenue bonds, the proceeds can be used to buy a building or buy equipment. Not a lot of jobs created in that. So what this bill does is expands the use of the proceeds to include research and development and some working capital regarding the acquisition of any capital assets. It's a good bill. I am overwhelmed with the cooperation of the Treasurer's Office, the Business Oregon, the Governor's Office, our bond counsel. We all sat around a table and kind of hashed this out and figured out a way to make this work that was acceptable to all. And I would like to congratulate those departments on coming forward with a really good piece of legislation that I think can really have an impact on economic development in Oregon. I'm happy to answer any questions. I also want to introduce, and I think they've probably signed up, that we've got the Economic Development Director from Central Oregon here. We have parties that are involved with potential businesses coming here. And again, this is a tool for the entire state of Oregon, not just Central Oregon, although this is the catalyst to this. I have the mayor of Redmond here. What else do I have here? I have economic development from Redmond ready here, and Treasurer's Office is here to answer any technical questions, and the star of the program, Business Oregon, I believe John Saris is here, as well as Paul, I think, are here, but to testify with the details of it. So if you have any questions, I'm happy to address them, but I really think the technical people who have done the heavy lifting on this would be your better option.
Thank you. Any questions of the senator? Thank you, Senator.
Thank you.
And we'll start off with the people from Central Oregon, who are more than 100 miles away. Roger Lee, Linda Nelson, and John Stark. You want to all come up together?
Save you some time, maybe.
Welcome.
Well, good afternoon. For the record, my name is Roger Lee. I'm the Executive Director of Economic Development for Central Oregon, a nonprofit organization that covers Crook, Deschutes, and Jefferson counties. And I guess you could say we're a little bit of the reason why this bill has come up, but the real reason is to my left here, and I think she'll get a chance to talk a little bit more about that. But we do have a kind of a bird in hand, so to speak, on a particular project that could create hundreds of jobs, invest tens of millions of dollars into the Central Oregon economy, the Oregon economy overall, obviously. And just ask for your support on this particular bill. Appreciate your willingness to carry this and Senator Telfer's interest in getting it to this stage. So I'll just make a few points. You've got some written testimony. The Oregon Economic Development Association, which we've been active members of for years, has a pretty short legislative agenda for this short session. And this is one of about a handful of bills that is on their kind of their official agenda for this February session. So I just say that they've understand, I think, the gravity that this could have, not only just for this particular project, but for other projects in the state where private activity bond financing could really be attract what we think are most likely going to be knowledge-based companies, knowledge-based industries with high-paying jobs that will put Oregon back to work. And I'll keep my comments to that. Appreciate your support.
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, I'm John Stark for the record. I work for Redmond Economic Development. It's a partner organization to EDCO with a separate autonomous board of directors. I was before you here 2 weeks ago, a little easier drive today. I won't spend much time talking about the weather, but it was certainly enjoyable today. If you will, I'd like to share a few points of feedback here. You know, you may be aware of some of the high unemployment in Central Oregon today. That high employment has been as high as 20% in some of our local towns. Our mayor has established an initiative to create 10,000 jobs by 2030. These are well-paying, what we call family wage jobs. Currently, as mentioned by the good senator, that we have a potential interest in Redmond that has a substantial amount of job creation behind it. They've shared that this particular method of financing is a preference to them and one of their investors. And so this particular project will go a long way in creating jobs and increasing the average wage within the Central Oregon area, more specifically Redmond. Certainly, the immediate opportunity is here. There are some long-term opportunities as well. This is a tool that at least four or five other states, four that we've confirmed, are using today in their economic development toolbox. When we're competing against bags of money, oftentimes from other states, being creative and providing opportunities certainly that are revenue neutral or financially neutral for the state are of an advantage for us, and we appreciate your support of this particular bill that will help us in the immediate future as well as long term. Thank you.
Thank you. Linda?
Chairman, members of the committee, thank you for your time. My name is Linda Nelson. I'm from Redmond, Oregon. I guess you could say that it's my fault that this started. I have been involved with the technology company that Roger and John have referred to since 2007 and was aware of the significant potential of the technologies for job creation and economic development. When they ran into problems with their location deal in another jurisdiction, I made a shameless pitch for Central Oregon and opened the door for EDCO to make a presentation as to the advantages of the state and the region. They did a fabulous job to the point that Oregon went from not even being on the list to the top of the list within a fairly short period of time. But we ran into this one issue that because they're a high-growth company, they need working capital, And because they're a technology company, they need to invest in R&D. So they wanted to be able to use a portion of the proceeds for their $80 million bond financing, for which they already have a private investor in hand for these purposes. And like many state statutes, Oregon pretty much copied the language from the tax-exempt programs over to the taxable programs, even though there's really no reason, because you don't have the same IRS issues that play into the taxable programs. So this bill, I think this will be one of the easier decisions you get to make this session. You're just tweaking an existing program. There's no cost. There's actually no risk. These are non-recourse bonds, private activity bonds. The state's fully indemnified by the private investor who has their own bond counsel and does their own due diligence. So I think this is a win-win for the state. It puts another tool in the hands of people like John and Roger and other economic development professionals in the state. And with particular urgency for right now, it makes possible the location of this company to Central Oregon, which has a lot of potential to create jobs in itself, but I think also is very exciting with respect to its contribution to the economic infrastructure in the region because of the multiplier effects. They're not just one product line that they're involved in, but multiple product lines with technologies that have applications across multiple markets. So thank you for your time.
And thank you, Linda, for making the call. Anything we can do to get jobs into Oregon is right on target.
Thank you,
questions,
Tim,
of this panel? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Well, let's go to the department then. Mike, John, and Paul.
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, for the record, Mike Salvaggio from the Office of the State Treasurer. I am simply here to convey the Treasury's approval of the legislation before you, Senate Bill 1558, as amended by the Dash 1 amendments. And we'd like to thank Senator Telfer and Business Oregon for helping to add this resource to our economic development battery. I would like to add briefly that although the bonds do not constitute an obligation of the state, it's still one of our responsibilities to ensure that anything with the state's imprimatur on it is handled in a responsible manner. We do believe we have the confidence that given the way that the legislation is set up, given the Dash 1 amendments, and given Business Oregon's sufficient oversight, this meets with our approval, and we would advise to pass it out as amended.
Great.
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Paul Grove with Business Oregon. As Mike noted, appreciate the opportunity to come here today and appreciate the efforts of Senator Telfer engaging the Treasurer, Business Oregon, as well as Bond Council. This was a deliberative process and went through a number of different iterations to get to the bill that we're at today. And we feel that the Dash 1 amendments allow us to provide a sufficient and level of oversight with respect to these projects, but the flexibility and the ability to capitalize on potential opportunities that may present themselves moving forward. And we have John Saris here, our finance manager.
Paul, we don't have the Dash 1 amendment in front of us. So I guess, what does the Dash 1, if we had it, what would it say?
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, I will defer to John Saris, our finance manager, who can speak in greater detail as to the Dash 1s. He has a greater familiarity with the program and its administration. So.
John, just for the benefit of the committee, I don't know how familiar people are with the Industrial Revenue Bonding Program. I've worked with it for many, many years, but you explain how it works and what the liability state is.
Chair Beyer, member of the committee, for the record, my name is John Saris. I'm the Business Services Manager at the Oregon Business Development Department. Real briefly, as an overview, the Industrial Revenue Development Bonds is a program where the state acts as a conduit issuer of the bonds. Basically, a project's identified. The state determines the eligibility of the project to ensure that it meets the criteria, and a financer typically provides the capital that's necessary for the project. Typically, these have been in the past associated with capital-based assets, so we're talking about equipment, new facilities, expansion of existing facilities, and there have been some provisions for working capital, but this these amendments essentially, or this bill essentially expands the allowable eligible uses of the program. The amendments to the bill basically do a couple of different things. We want to make sure that there's appropriate safeguards put into place to protect both the name of the state and the integrity of the program itself. And most specifically, what it does is make sure that the benefit of the bonds that are being issued is realized here in the state of Oregon. There is the possibility that there may be some tax-exempt financing that is afforded to the borrower through this process, and for that reason, and because the state bond allocation is used, should justify the benefit being realized here in the state. The other provisions within the amendment basically kind of correspond to some federal expansions to the exempt facilities bonds that are able to be issued through these statutes, and basically just helps facilitate the flow of capital to these businesses that are seeking to expand in Oregon. So,
now, John, this is a federal program that's existed for many years, and so all of these uses that we're talking about here are allowable under the federal law.
They are allowable under the federal law. What they may not be is exempt from federal income tax as part of the project. That may cost the borrower a little bit more money, but they can be issued under what's called a taxable tail.
And essentially the state's role is just to say, yep, this conforms with the rules, and then it's up to the, if you will, borrower to find someone who's willing to finance the project, and the relationship is directly there, and the state has no liability.
Chair Byer, members of the committee, you're correct. The liability is with the lender.
So this is just another opportunity to make a little more money available to businesses who are in Oregon or would wish to come to Oregon. In this case, apparently a new technology company. Questions of the panel? Okay. Thank you very much. Is there anybody else? That's all I had on my sign-up sheet. Is there anybody else who wishes to do this? Seeing none. Colleagues, given the fact that we're in a very short session here and the amendment hasn't caught up, what I think I would like to do is move the bill down to revenue where it has to do, then let the amendment catch up down there. I think it's just a technical amendment. I'm looking at the chair of the revenue committee, and that works for you. Did that work for people?
I'm looking for a nod from my member of the Revenue Committee.
Perfect.
I think we got that one covered. Okay, we will close the public hearing, open a work session on Senate Bill 1558, and the chair moves Senate Bill 1558 to revenue with a do pass recommendation. Discussion on the motion. Seeing none, is there any objections to the motion? Senate Bill 1558 is moved to revenue with a do pass recommendation, and we'll close the public hearing. We will open a public hearing, work session, excuse me. We will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1544. Patrick, excuse me.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I'm in my old habit with Richard sitting next to me.
It's easy to get us mixed up. It happens all the time.
But he had hair.
A lot of hair. Senate Bill 1544 was one of the bills we introduced as a committee bill. This measure designates a 465-acre site within the city of Redmond as a site of statewide economic development significance and exempts it from specified transportation planning requirements and access management standards. The measure has an emergency clause. Would take effect upon passage. We have not yet received fiscal or revenue impact statements on the measure. That is not true. We have received a no revenue impact statement on the measure. However, we submitted just today amendments to Legislative Council that are the product of an agreement that I believe several of our witnesses will be talking to, Mr. Chair.
Okay. With that, Senator Telfer, would you like to come up along with Mayor Endicott? And Mr. Lee, if you want to come up too, that'd be great. We spent a lot of time on this during our last legislative days held a public hearing, so I'm not sure how much detail we have to go into. My understanding is that we've had a lot of discussion between the city and the departments, ODOT specifically, and DLCD, so we're hopefully, I don't think we have the final amendment in front of us, but I don't want you to have to drive 100 miles again, Mayor. So, Senator.
Oh, thank you, Chairman Beyer and members of the committee. I'm here just because I like you all so very much, and it's just nice to be in front of you on an ongoing basis. We have presented this before. I'm Senator Chris Telfer from Senate District 27. We've presented this before. I know we have a lot to accomplish in 29 days. I won't go into details on the bill. That's already been done. I will defer most of my comments or all my comments to the gentleman to my left. I do want to state that I'm appreciative of the committee taking on this piece of legislation, and particularly to Senator Beyer for taking the time to come over to sunny Central Oregon and spend a few hours over there and looking at various issues that we have. So my appreciation for that. And with that, I will turn it over to the mayor of Redmond.
Thank you, Senator. Good afternoon, Chair Beyer and committee members. My name is George Endicott. I am the mayor of Redmond. And sitting here with me today, as you can see to my immediate left, is our EDCO member. I guess he's going to speak after me. I was going to give a little detail on the bill, but I obviously don't need to do that since Mr. Patrick did that already. I'm here supporting Senate Bill 1544. I was before you just a couple of weeks ago on January 18th that the senator referred to. At that time, it was LC 186. Senator Beyer and you committee members understand that the proposed bill needed some refinements. I'm here to report that the City of Redmond, the Department of Land Conservation and Development, and the Oregon Department of Transportation held those meetings, had some tough negotiations, even heated at times, but came through with a bill with which we can all be satisfied. There were several ambiguities that needed addressing and clarifying language that each desired. We held a total of 3 meetings to reach this agreement, and we have done so. The state is in need of some significant large lot industrial lands. Central Oregon has the land and is in need of the jobs and the economic development. This bill will meet all of those criteria. So if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Okay. Roger.
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, back again. First of all, thanks of all for scheduling such an efficient way to testify. So I'll keep it short. This particular properties that are in question on this, we've tried to market actually to companies in the past. In some cases, very significant projects, technology companies again. The simple process that it has to go through today really knocked it out of the running. In fact, I think I remember the comments saying, why are we even looking at this property given the kind of land use stuff that would have to go through and so forth. So I think this is a really critical part of our overall economic development strategy in Central Oregon to be able to have this type of larger lot industrial land that's available inside an urban growth boundary, inside city limits with all the services nearby. And we intend, as the region's primary marketing and economic development organization, to try to put some facilities and companies in that area. So just an addition to my comments that were submitted on January 18th, back when it was LC 186. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions of this panel? Thank you all, and thank you for all the hard work and driving all the way over.
Thank you.
Hopefully a little safer trip this time than the last time, huh?
Yes, sir.
Mr. Halliburton and Ms. Bohart, if do you want to comment on this at all? You guys have really done a lot of hard work on this. I know we don't have the amendment in front of us, but I know you've been working on it. It's down in LC. With that amendment, generally, are you okay?
For the record, Jerry Bohard with the Oregon Department of Transportation, Chair Beyer, committee members, yes, I would say that the agency is satisfied with what has transpired in the three meetings that we held with the city, and really would like to say appreciate the opportunity to work through the issues with the city, and I think we reached a place that we can all work from.
I'm Rob Halliburton with the Department of Land Conservation and Development, and I agree with what Ms. Bohard just said.
Okay. Anybody have any questions?
That's it.
I can keep going if you would like.
Exactly. For the benefit of committee members, I'll tell you, having worked with these the staff of both DLCD and ODOT on this and on the rules, you remember, issue that we'll take up in a bill next week, they've done an extraordinary job of trying to reach the concerns and resolve the concerns that we heard expressed during the session, and I really appreciate the work they've done on this as well as the other bill. Really very helpful and really attuned to trying to put the state in a position where we can receive some of the benefits of economic development when it comes around. So thank you both very much for that.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
Okay, so I have two other people signed up here, Brian Craig and Jonathan Patton. You both want to come up? That'd be cool.
Oh, Brian's back. Okay.
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, Brian Krieg, representing the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, the sheet metal workers of Local 16, the contractors of PMCA and SMACNA today. And we're here to support this bill. Let's get some jobs going. Let's go build some stuff in this state.
You're here.
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, my name is Jonathan Manton, testifying today on behalf of Central Oregon Land Watch. And I testified earlier a few weeks ago as to some of our concerns over initially just kind of the idea that we would have the transportation planning rule process that take place for so long and then to create an exception very early on. But I want to thank Senator Telfer and the chair for convening a meeting in which we were able to kind of understand more of the issues, understand that this is a very unique property with a unique history, unique circumstances, and as we kind of learn more about it, to see that this is a piece of land that makes perfect sense for industrial development, and that based on the agreement that, as we understand it, we support this legislation and very much wish the folks in Redmond and Edco good fortune in helping to bring some jobs to the area.
Thank you both. Questions to this panel?
Mr. Chair, I don't know who to ask this question of, but I know that Thousand Friends has a letter in here expressing some concern about the statewide application of this. And in this work meeting, has that concern been resolved that you know of?
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, I certainly don't want to speak for another organization, but on behalf of Central Oregon Land Watch, what we understand is that those issues were resolved, that this would just be limited to this one particular site with its kind of unique circumstances and would not have any statewide impact.
And you've analyzed it independently and came to that?
Madam, Mr. Chair, Senator Burdick, yes, that's correct.
Thank you.
Senator, I don't know if Rob, if you want to address, I think it's narrowed specifically the site and would not have statewide application. I know there was some concern, Senator, that it might be precedent setting. I don't believe it is myself. This is a very unique site. I've looked at it. I will tell you that on a phone call last week, was it? I think it was, George? Was it Monday, I guess it was. We had both representatives from Land Watch, Central Oregon, and Thousand Friends, and both of them said, we support this application.
Okay.
Now, that was the local representatives. I don't know whether that's consistent with statewide or not. But thank you. Of note on the land use side, I will tell you that this land, what's unique, one of the things unique about it is it's entirely in public ownership. It's entirely within the urban growth boundary of Redmond, and it used to be zoned industrial.
Well, I think, you know, just to follow up on that, I think, you know, as a former commissioner on Land Conservation and Development Commission, I've always agreed very strongly that the land use program is a contract in an exchange for protecting land outside of the urban growth boundary. We do have to have, we have to make it easy for development inside the urban growth boundary. And that's what sounds like you're trying to get at.
Yeah, I'm completely in agreement with that, having spent about 25 years on city planning commissions. I get it. And I support that. Okay, anybody else? Seeing none, we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1544. Colleagues, we can't move this today because we don't have the latest amendment, nor do we have a fiscal, so we'll have to carry it over to our next meeting. So with that, we will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1546. Patrick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 1546, also a committee bill we introduced during session, provides an exemption to the Department of Transportation for the need to obtain a local permit prior to removing trees. It permits the department to inspect and condemn trees that pose a potential immediate and substantial risk of damage or injury by obstructing, hanging over, or otherwise encroaching on, or threatening to encroach in any manner on a state highway. It increases the amount of the minimum appraised value of forest products that's required for the Department of Transportation to place the forest products for sale at public auction. We have just this afternoon received a dash one amendment to this. I believe Senator Johnson is prepared to speak to that, Mr. Chair. Okay. Other than that, the bill itself has no fiscal or revenue impact.
Senator.
Thank you.
The floor is yours.
With the chair's permission, may I bring up Team Senate Bill 1546?
Sir.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Betsy Johnson. I have the privilege of representing Senate District 16. And when we were last together at the height of the storms in the week of January that encompassed legislative days, we discussed with you carnage on the roads. We discussed with you floods. We discussed with you slides. We showed you a film. Mr. Gonzalez and I carried the day. We return this time with the Sheriff of Clatsop County, Tom Bergen, who is going to talk to you a little bit more about the bill. I want to just make an opening comment before I start. On the last bill, as a native daughter of Redmond, I know that property well, and I commend Senate Bill 1544 for your positive consideration. That's a good bill. The amendments that you received today came to my attention as well from the Department of Forestry, and I think that they have a representative here today, Mr. Doherty. These were amendments that had been agreed to the last time that this concept was before the legislature as Senate Bill 455. Because the bill didn't move, the amendments were never amended in. I will try to summarize, and if Mr. Doherty begins nodding his head in a bad direction, you'll know that I'm not telling the truth. But these were an agreement between the Department of Forestry and the Department of Transportation so that the Department of Forestry was not looking over every cut that the Department of Transportation did. But there are representatives from ODOT here as well and Forestry that can speak to the amendments. Certainly, I don't think any of us have any objection to the amendments. I would respectfully ask that Sheriff Bergen be able to make his case for the bill, and then we'll retire and let others that have signed up to testify do so.
Okay.
Thank you.
Sure.
Chair Beyer. My second favorite senator, Vice Chair Atkinson, and Betsy's first. I like your forthrightness, obviously. I'm the same way. So anyway.
So should I ask him who his first favorite senator is?
Yeah.
Betsy. Sorry.
A Democrat. I just wanted to get you on the record here. You can't start at number two.
We got to get our bill.
Only for another hour. A Democrat and a Republican, that's pretty good. So, anyway, as you know, and committee members, thank you very much for allowing me to speak. As you know, last 2 weeks ago, I was unable to make it. Our road 26 was shut down for approximately 12 hours. In 1971, the Forest Practice Act came into, I guess, our being, so to speak, and it was a good thing. It's done a lot of very good things for us. However, 40 years later, it needs to be revised, and for the last 3 years, we've worked diligently on a committee with numerous people from ODOT, Pacific Power, State Forestry, all different walks of life, private timber owners, small companies, and so on, to put together a bill that works fluidly for the state of Oregon. And this is something that is very important because not only does it damage the same roads over and over and over, shutting down the guardrails, you saw the movie, or shutting down the roads, damaging guardrails, damaging wires. We've had people killed up there, children hitting trees hitting vehicles, crushing them in their vehicles, ODOT workers, the same thing. It puts the ODOT workers, the power line workers in harm's way. This is a daily event during windstorms and ice storms and snowstorms. So it also stops police and fire. It also stops, more importantly, medical issues. A lot of times we cannot fly to Portland through helicopters because of the coast range, so we have to evacuate through ambulances. And when the roads are shut down, there's no around it. So you saw the movie last time, and I'm just telling you that it's finally come to a point in that we need to do something about this. And I think after the last 2 years of this committee being together, that we've really come up with a good solution. And I hope that you will move forward in a positive way and endorse this bill. And thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, two other comments. I feel, given issues that have been raised with me in the last 24 hours, I'd like to get two other things on the record. This is not intended to deal with decorative trees. I think that one of the Central Oregon cities has raised the questions about whether or not we're trying to deprive them of their appellation as a tree city. We are not. We are trying to do exactly what Sheriff Bergen said, save lives and save economic infrastructure. The second thing I'd like to bring to your attention is that the bill may be a little ambiguous about who retains the economic interest in the cut tree. And I would like to say, for the record, the intent of this bill was not to deprive owners of a chance to get economic value out of a cut tree. We want to make sure that ODOT does any harvesting with the owners, not to them, so that if the owner needs to take down a danger tree, it could be timed in a way that they might get a whole load of trees, or if different cuts were being done, that they could gather enough trees to take a log truck to the mill. So in no way do we want to deprive private property owners of the economic value of the raw lumber, or make the economies of cutting and shipping more difficult. We want to be cooperative with the private landowners, all in the name of safety and retaining the economic infrastructure that is historically damaged year after year by storms.
Just real quick, we've noticed last week when we were shut down, and I sent Betsy my text that was supposed to be personal, but she read it to y'all, so which is okay. We noticed that Highway 26 actually opened up quicker. It took 12 and a half hours compared to Highway 18. There has been no work done along Highway 18 and some of the other highways. Highway 26, ODOT has started doing a little bit of work. We were able to get our highway opened in 12 hours, and it took them over 20 hours to get 18 open. So some of the unintended consequences from the Forest Practice Act, you know, from 40 years ago, and now we're starting to clean up some of the roads again and getting them slightly back where they need to be, have actually proven to be very beneficial to the current situation. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair.
Chairman Beyer, members of the committee, I concur with the statements from Senator Johnson and Sheriff Bergen. I'll be happy to address any questions you may have. I chair the committee that worked on this bill today for over 2.5 years, and it was a multi-agency effort: power companies, law enforcement, legal counsel, and a private company on the high-tech side to help us with GIS mappings and so forth. The amendments to the statute that you have are tools for ODOT to more effectively address the issue of the danger trees along the rights of ways. And again, just to reinforce what Senator Johnson said, the intent of this bill is to address strictly danger trees, trees that are posing imminent dangers to the highways and freeways along the state of Oregon. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Let's see. Let's get ODOT up here and ODF, Paul and Peter.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Paul Mather, Oregon Department of Transportation, Highway Division Administrator. In my testimony, which is the same testimony that I had during the interim session, I'm not going to go through that unless has questions. During the interim, you were able to see the video. I do want to indulge you with showing you a couple of slides here. Some of this will be a little bit redundant, but I think it'll help answer some of the questions that we were talking about during the interim testimony, and particularly, what are we trying to accomplish with the bill? So what does the situation look like before, and then what does it look like after the trees are cut? And I got some pictures in here to show you that to demonstrate the position here. So first, a couple of slides actually from while we were testifying a couple weeks ago. This is on Highway 18. This is the area that was closed for about 24 hours in the Van Duzer corridor. That's the same corridor. These are some of the more historic pictures, again, similar to what you saw in the video. It affects workers. Our workers are at risk, and oftentimes during these situations, we pull our workers back and say, you can't even go in there just because trees are coming down. It's such a dangerous situation, we can't even be in there. So this is what the sheriff was talking about, and I've actually been watching this since we've been working with this committee and working on this. We've been focusing on the Highway 30 and Highway 26 corridor to do some work within the limits that we do have. And during the last couple of windstorms, we've actually seen a difference in those corridors where, as you can see in the slide here, shows you the number of incidences at the peak of the storm. We had much less influence in or impact in the Highway 30 and Highway 26 corridor, where in 18, 20, Highway 34, we had much more severe impacts. And here's a few more corridors. But here's really what I wanted to get to. This kind of shows you what the situation looks like kind of in an everyday before the storm. So you have largely alder trees or trees that are hanging over the highway and look fairly innocent until the wind blows or the snow or the ice comes. This is a slide shot of a work in progress. So this is a contract or our crews out doing work. Yeah, typically we take a lane and have crews out there doing the work. And then here's a picture of what it looks like when we're done. So it's not a clear cut, clear back. It's providing a clear zone to keep the trees that would normally fall in the highway, give them a place to fall before they come across the roadway. So I just wanted to get to those few slides just to illustrate really what we're talking about here with the intent of the bill and what ODOT's efforts are to keep these highways open during these winter events. With that, I'll take questions.
I guess one, we have a letter from, I believe it was the city of Madras and some others concerned about street trees within a city. Can you address how this might affect that? And
yeah, this would not affect that. That the incident that happened in Madras last year was an incident, unfortunate incident that should not have happened. We had an employee that was a little overzealous in clearing trees in front of a sign that he thought was blocking the view of the sign and cut trees down in an area that should not have been cut down. We actually sent a letter to the city apologizing for those efforts and have committed this spring to replant those trees.
Chair Byer, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Peter Doherty, Private Forest Division Chief. I came here only to clarify the -1 amendments. These are simply to provide more specificity to the required consultation between the Department of Forestry and Department of Transportation. In the initial bill, the wording requires us to consult on all clear cuts in the state of Oregon. The -1 amendment merely clarifies that we're required to consult in those situations where there's a safety issue or an infrastructure risk issue. We're committed to working with the Department of Transportation to efficiently and effectively implement these provisions if this bill moves forward. Thank you.
Thank you, Peter. Any questions of this panel? Thank you most, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Okay, Roger Byer, Ted Case, and how about Ron Epstor?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Roger Byer, here representing the Oregon Small Woodland Association. With Senator Johnson's statements, my concerns over the bill are greatly alleviated. My basic concern was, and first I'd like to put on the record, the Oregon Small Woodlands Association fully supports ODOT being able to go onto our property and remove danger trees if they are there. The question would then become, who owns the tree once it is cut? And Senator Johnson clarified that the intent of this bill is not to change ownership of the tree. That was our concern. I believe somewhere else, there is a statute that would clarify that. This bill, there is nothing in this bill that indicates who owns the tree. It simply says, under current law, I might add, under what has become Section 3, the department may go upon private property to cut down or remove trees located on the property without notifying the property owner if the department has determined that the trees create an immediate and substantial risk of damage or injuries. Mr. Chair, that is current law. So the question I have is, what does remove the tree mean under current law? And as long as we're in the complete understanding that the private landowner gets to keep ownership of the tree, we have no problem with this bill. I would just point out that under the new section that would be added to the current law of ORS 366-365, if the department has time to notify me or attempt to notify me as they would be required to under the condemnation statutes, if they then have time to go and find an arborist to come look at the tree and determine if it is in fact a danger tree before they can cut down the tree, I would like to believe they have time to talk to me as a landowner so that potentially I could go and turn that tree and a few of its friends beside it into a load of logs and maybe create some economic activity for myself and for the state of Oregon. So that's our intent. Good bill. With that clarification, be happy to support it, and hopefully we can get that answered. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Roger. Just for the record, legislative intent, as I understand it, is to do exactly as you said, that I suspect that ODOT and Forestry would prefer to have the property owner cut the tree and keep the logs and sell the logs. Ted.
Chair, by members of the committee, my name is Ted Case. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Rural Electric Cooperative Association. ORESA represents 18 electric cooperatives, 200,000 members, and millions of more trees. And that is why I'm here today in very strong support of this legislation. Senator Johnson has described the carnage, particularly took place in West Oregon Electric Cooperative, one of my members, with down power lines in the roadway, inabilities to get around to get the power back up there because of the trees in the road. So this is a bill whose time has come. You've had a lot of testimony on it, excellent testimony. Just say we have a very good working relationship with ODOT, but sometimes we have the perception that they don't have the tools and flexibility to do the job that needs to be done, and I think this bill goes a long way to give them those flexibility. So great bill, should pass. Thank you.
Senator Edwards.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to I think everybody's on the same page here. I don't know, and I think we should keep this bill moving along. I think everybody's on the same page and the same intent. I don't have necessarily a ton of faith that people on the ground will go back and pull up the tapes about the legislative intent when it comes time to actually clear trees out of the way. And so, you know, landowners don't always, you know, it's not necessarily an instance where you drive up the driveway and knock on the door and say, okay, you know, and have that face-to-face conversation and figure out how they're going to keep possession of the trees or logs that have been cut down. So I think that can all be worked out, but I just wanted to register some concern. As one legislator on this committee, that I think that even though all the people of goodwill sitting here are on the same page, I hope that you all have confidence that that will actually play out in the field, and that you know, you have a process in place for contacting the landowners ahead of time and organizing how that work happens. And if you're not able to get a hold of a landowner and you have to just come in and do that work, where are you going to stack the logs? Are they just going to be downed and left next to the side of the road, or are you hauling them away somewhere never to be seen again? I would like to have some clarification for the landowners. So,
Mr. Chair, if I could,
there's another side of this building that could be done on.
I appreciate the comments by Senator Edwards, and that's it gets exactly to the concern I expressed. I believe that, and I don't know, you know, if legislative council or someone could do a little checking, there's probably a statute somewhere that speaks to who owns the tree. If there's not, there's clearly a document called the Constitution that says if government comes and takes my property, they got to pay me for it. So I believe that I hope there's a statute already someplace in Chapter 366 someplace that speaks to that. I don't have that documentation in front of me, but I would love to have the same clarification you would like to have.
Senator, just a comment from my prior life as the chair of the PUC when he was there, and having watched the incident that Mr. Gonzalez talked about, I think the chances of meeting your concerns are greater with this bill than the current situation where ODOT and forestry are dealing with trees that are down over the with hot wires bouncing right. around and trying yeah. to get trucks through, when frankly they're just going to go in and I know they did is cut them in half and push them off to the side, because that's all you can do at right. that point, because what's important is public safety.
That makes sense.
So I think it probably works better under this scenario where they can actually have the time to go and talk to Roger or his friend and say, we have a problem here. How would you like to deal with it? Senator.
You know, there's just to add on that conversation, there's nothing stopping the department from creating a database. They already know where the roads are, and we already, just through basic county mapping, you know who the owners are, and building a database of who all the owners are with a contact list in advance. I mean, that's that could be done fairly easily, and have that double-checked with Roger, because Roger's really good at all the details for the entire state, and that could be done before a storm. I would like to volunteer Senator Roger Beyer to put all that together. But that could be done in advance.
But he's only got the small lot owners.
Yeah, but he's...
There's more of us. He's got okay.
But it could be done in advance is the yeah. point. I mean, we do that all the time.
Sure.
Through...
Good point. More?
Sir. Chair Beyer, members of the committee, Ron Papsdorf, City of Gresham, city in the Portland metro area of about 105,000 people, and believe me, I'm not here to get in the way of this rolling log truck. However, and to the extent that we wholeheartedly agree with the objective of the department to deal with truly hazardous trees, on some key highway corridors in the state, we do think there are some. Can be some significant differences between those situations and situations in an urban area in a city, and it doesn't make us feel too great to have local tree ordinances preempted by this legislation. And so we would like the opportunity to work with the department and with Senator Johnson to see if we can find some language on the other end of this building around clarifying compliance, particularly in cities, around some of the other tree ordinance components that exist, that we would still like the department to have to comply with those, even if they've identified a hazardous tree and had to go in and remove it without first getting a local permit, which, by the way, at least in Gresham, we think is not an onerous process for a hazardous tree. Come in and fill out a one-page form telling us and supplying the information from the arborist that it's a hazardous tree, and you go cut down the tree. However, we do have a local ordinance that does require replacement, because we have local objectives for maintaining an adequate urban forest, for a lot of the other benefits that they provide, including environmental benefits, cutting down stormwater runoff, and providing shade and cooling to urban streams, some of the things that we're trying to do in order to restore fish habitat to some of our stream corridors as well. So with that kind of objection noted, and we certainly stand ready to work with the department to see if we can at least clarify the requirement to come back and work with, and comply with other local tree ordinance requirements once they've removed a hazardous tree.
Mr. Hapstorff, I appreciate your concern. I suspect that you're not going to see a problem in the city so much, but your concerns, maybe not with this legislation, but with Mr. Gonzalez wearing a different hat, the PUC, when he tells the utilities they have to cut the trees so that they're not in the utility lines. That's okay. Thank you. Any questions of this panel, members? Thank you, gentlemen, very much. And Mr. Honeyman.
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, thank you very much for hearing my testimony this afternoon. I'm Craig Honeyman, Legislative Director of League of Oregon Cities. I'm going to sort of sound a familiar refrain from Mr. Papsdorf's testimony from just a moment ago. Let me say at the outset, the League does not oppose Senate Bill 1546. We share the concern that public safety, protection of property is paramount. After all, on state highways that go through cities where there are risks found, it is our citizens who are at risk just as much. So we don't want to stand in the way of safety. There's no question about that. In fact, with the possible exception of whatever happened in Madras, and frankly, I'm not familiar with that situation, it's my understanding that cities and ODOT in the past have worked fairly well together on this kind of issue. Further, we're not concerned about any sort of capricious decision-making with regard to what trees stay and what trees go. The bill clearly identifies the need for an arborist finding before a tree can be taken out. So having said all of that, what would make this bill even more comfortable to cities would be some understanding, and whether that's done through an expression of legislative intent, an amendment to this bill either here or on the other side of the building, or some agreement with ODOT. I'm open to discussion about how that would work, but there'd be some understanding or agreement for notification of a city after the fact, ex post facto, if you will, by the department when a tree has been taken out. And then beyond that, that there be some recognition given to the need to observe city ordinances and other local provisions related to tree removal after the tree is gone, relating to issues such as replacement with appropriate vegetation, concerns about mitigating the effect of slopes, the fact that the tree's not there, the impact that that might have on slope protection and that sort of thing. So with that, I will conclude. Again, we're not opposing the bill. We think it could be even better, and we look forward to working to make that happen if we have the opportunity. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Craig. Any questions of Craig? Paul, do you want to take a shot at that at all?
My suspicion is that you, ODOT really doesn't have a lot of, doesn't see this as a inside city's bill at all.
Yeah, again, Paul Mather, or Oregon Department of Transportation, chaired by our members of the committee, yes, that's not our intent. We wouldn't have any problem with changes that would that Craig has outlined here. The intent of the bill is for rural areas with trees coming across the road, largely with large property owners. I do, while I'm up here, I do was doing some research on statutes that do cover ownership of trees, notification, storage. We do have statutes that cover those things already in statute. So some of your concerns, Senator Edward, are already covered.
Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you very much, gentlemen. That is all I have signed up to testify. Is there anybody else who wishes to testify on Senate Bill 1546? Seeing none, I will close the public hearing and open a work session. Members, we can't move this bill today, but I would like to get the dash ones adopted so that we can get a fiscal on it for our next meeting.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash ones.
Senator Atkinson has moved the dash one amendments to Senate Bill 1546. Is there discussion on the motion? Seeing none, is there any objection to the motion? Motion is adopted. The dash ones are adopted into Senate Bill 1546, and we will close the work session on Senate Bill 1546 and open a work session on Senate Bill 1547.
Public hearing.
Excuse me, public hearing. Thank you, Senator. Patrick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 1547, yet another greatest hit from the interim of the Senate Business Transportation Committee. This measure is the one that allows the director of the Department of DCBS to authorize captive insurers in the state of Oregon. It would outline standards for those insurers with regard to formation, licensing, classes of insurance transacted, and reporting. It exempts certain documents of captive insurers from disclosure as public records, adopts tax treatment for captive insurers, becomes operative on July 1st, 2012, declares an emergency, takes effect upon passage. We have in your packets the Dash 1 Amendment. The Dash 1 Amendment represent a collaborative effort between the proponents of the measure and the department's insurance division. Those amendments, we have received back a fiscal impact statement, which is in your packet, and a legislative revenue impact statement as well. The legislative fiscal office, in issuing its fiscal impact statement, also clicked the button that sends committee staff a trigger that they would like this measure to receive a Ways and Means referral to be added by the committee so that the Ways and Means Committee can review it. Mr. Chair.
Those grabby people anyway.
Mr. Chair,
why?
Question for Patrick.
Yes.
Did they explain why that they want this bill in Ways and Means in the event that it has no fiscal impact, virtually no fiscal impact at all?
It has, Mr. Chair, Senator Starr, it has no net fiscal impact, but because there's monies coming in and monies going out, that's generally the reason, I believe, why. We could, if you'd like, ask the fiscal analyst to come down and address that if you'd like. I'd be happy to make that call right now.
Well, I would go with whatever the chair...
Do you want to hear from him?
Well,
let's ask him to come on down.
I mean, it's just...
I think it's silly as well.
Yeah.
It has no money impact to the state. It's just the creation of this insurance. So why do we need to...
We'll ask him to come down. We'll see what they have to say.
I don't know.
And in the meantime, I will... I guess I did open a public hearing on this. I don't have to do it again. Mr. Hargis?
I don't know why I asked to go there for expenditure limitation.
I don't think you need... You did a pretty good job last time telling us a lot about this, so you don't need to go into great detail unless committee members have a lot of questions.
For the record, I'm Gary Hargis. I live in Forest Grove, Oregon, and I was going to defer to you if we wanted to go through Captive 101, Chair.
It's a new line of insurance, right?
Yes, Chairman. And I'd be happy to answer any questions. I want to thank the committee for taking this up. My thanks can't be expressed well enough. And I'd like to thank the insurance division. They promised to work with us this past year, and it was a promise kept.
You might just remind us what this new line of insurance does.
Well, it's not really a new line of insurance. It's a new company structure. And what it does is it allows a... large company to start their own insurance company to insure itself and its affiliates. And so it doesn't really, I can briefly go through the first four paragraphs and might explain it better.
Go ahead.
But I'll have to read it. It's more technical than I like to memorize. The legislation allows companies like my own to domicile and manage captive insurance companies here in Oregon. Presently, this work by omission is not lawfully permitted in Oregon and must be carried out in other states. Senate Bill 1547 embodies the enabling legislation that opens up Oregon to this type of commerce. Here's the definition. A captive insurance company is a state-regulated limited license insurance company that insures the business operations of commonly owned entities. It is not self-insurance, nor is it a fully licensed insurance company capable of selling insurance to third parties. As an insurance company, it's regulated and reports to the state insurance commissioner. Captive insurance companies are valuable tools for risk management of exposures not otherwise insurable. That probably gives you the drift. It goes from the very simple to the very complicated. And what we did was we told the Department of Insurance that we would start off with the very simple varieties so that there could be some institutional knowledge gained on how to regulate these, because they can get quite complicated. And so we put together a bill that allowed the most simple forms through. And what we want to do is start a new industry here. It will employ accountants, attorneys, actuaries. It'll keep capital in Oregon, and it's an industry we'll start from scratch.
Okay. Questions, Greg? Thank you very much. Sal?
Thank you. Just very quickly, Mr. Chair, J.L. Wilson with Associated Oregon Industries. We took this issue up. AOI likes this issue a great deal. We endorsed it heartily at our board meeting earlier in the week. We support the bill as a new avenue for commercial activity and investment and hopefully some job creation in the state, but we really like the bill.
Okay. Any questions, J.L.? Thank you. Jeanette, just a question. I know the department... can't take positions on bills unless the governor has, but you tell us a little bit, is this, you've been working with them, is this, what can you tell us about the department's perspective on this?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Jeanette Holman. I'm a senior policy analyst over at the insurance division. And yes, we have been working extensively with the proponents of this bill. When it was introduced during the session It is truly a new kind of insurance company, and we were nervous about it. Came out late, and we were nervous about trying to get a bill together at that point that we were comfortable with. We have worked out all the details, and we are comfortable with that we can operate under this bill.
Is this going to create any new demands on the department to do it?
The fiscal impact is one position. That's what we are asking for, which is covered by the fees that the insurers will pay. So that's why it's revenue neutral. And that's primarily because we've never done it before, so we don't know exactly.
Yeah. My assumption was there's not going to be a huge demand for this. But
we're anticipating, I think the proponents are anticipating about 10 during the first biennium, 10 companies that would come in, and that'll increase, but so will our expertise. And I think that's consistent with what other states have found.
You need a position to do that.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you. Questions? Jeanette? We have, Raman, how would you like to come on up? The question that Senator Starr posed is why, since there's no general fund or any other funds, why is there a need for a referral to Ways and Means?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Robin Lamont from Legislative Fiscal. Any time that there is a budgetary action, regardless of the fund source, and any time that there is a position being established, that requires budgetary action. Therefore, the bill needs to come to Ways and Means for that action to occur.
Question?
Senator.
The question is, if we really do truly need a full-time employee to manage 10 different companies, I sit on Ways and Means, and I think that's absolutely ridiculous that a full-time employee be required to oversee the creation of these companies. So the obvious question is it going to require a full-time employee, or is it just going to require minor additional oversights by the agency?
And, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I did ask that question. I double-checked when I did the fiscal, and you also heard from the agency, and they believe it will require staffing.
Well, I don't know an agency in this state that says it won't require additional staffing. I mean, that's just kind of the way government grows, and they're looking for an excuse to grow. Listening to these arguments, I don't see where that's a legitimate concern. I mean, that's just my own personal thing.
Senator Starr, do you have any questions?
Well, I'm just, this creates more fun. So more people for me to have to wrangle with, I guess. And I was planning to wrangle with House members and policy committees. I guess now I get to wrangle with people down in Ways and Means to bust the bill out of there.
Well, one benefit is if it goes to Ways and Means, it comes out of there, it goes right to the House floor.
It goes to both floors. I understand that.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Durrett.
If it goes to Ways and Means, it's a dead bill.
Why?
Because there's no additional funds, and this is going to, if it requires additional funds, they're not going to pay
it. It's other fund revenue.
I think it's self-supporting.
It's a self-supporting bill. I just have to go down and I've already spent time talking to folks on the House side expecting this bill's going over there. So all that work kind of is not worthless, but worth less than it was earlier today.
Members, my sense is, I tend to agree with both of you, and this is not Ms. Lamont's issue. This is our,
right.
Our rules, so I don't think we have an option other than to send it down. That's all I have. Excuse me. Come on up. Was all I had that signed up, but you're welcome.
Senator Beyer and members of the committee, Jody Weiss with Taxpayers Oregon. I didn't sign up, although I've spent hours on this bill. Because I keep hoping I'm going to learn something that feels convincing instead of feeling reticent. We listened to the tapes. Larry Shrugs of our group is in Hawaii right now, but he's been working on the bill with me. And We re-listened to the tapes of the last hearing, and we've read the bill several times, and we've gone online and read everything we could, and we didn't take time to talk with proponents and who have more experience, which I wish we'd had time to do, but things have been moving pretty rapidly. And so our first question is, really, why is this legislation here, and who is it supposed to benefit? Because when we read the articles about this in the literature for businesses, it talks about it basically as a way to avoid taxation and spread risk. And we're, that risk part, we're not concerned about. The avoid taxation part, we are concerned about, because that would get our revenue stream. And the other issue that critics come up with is that there is not visibility into these captive insurance programs for the people who are actually being insured. And so there is uncertainty about whether there's actually enough capitalization left there to cover the risks that they're supposed to bear. Most insurance is quite publicly regulated, and you can really see what kind of assets they have inside the insurance company that are available to cover the risks that the company is supposed to be covering. The idea of captive insurance is under review by the IRS, which doesn't feel comfortable. We're told it's not self-insurance, but we're really not told what it is. If it's not self-insurance, what is it? If they're putting their money in and it's still their money, how is that not self-insurance? And how does it keep the money in Oregon? Because once the money is transferred, let's say from New Seasons into a captive insurance policy, it doesn't mean that they won't take that money and invest it in farmland in Texas. That would be my concern. I don't see anything in the law that puts constraints that would keep the money here. And the final thing is the department is concerned about needing someone to look at risk. And they're concerned about needing someone to look at risk because they've read what other states are saying about not, this is really complex. They put several different kinds of policies together, and it's not the kind of thing they're used to regulating. So then we tried to think of, well, what would be a personal experience that has any relationship to this? And I thought of the year that my brother and I had a fabulous year in lettuce, and we made $1 million, and we grossed $1 million, and we had about $900,000 of profit. And he was getting close to retiring, so we really didn't need to buy more machinery or more farmland with that money. So what we did with it was pay our taxes and take the remaining nearly $500,000 out of the farm and put it into the stock market, which wasn't necessarily in the state of California where the farm was. It just went where we happened to invest it, right? It would appear that under this plan, if we talked with the right insurance agency, he would say, well, you can take as much as $1.2 million, put it into your captive insurance fund, and you have now paid an insurance premium, and so you had no profit this year. You are allowed under the federal law to expense $1.2 million a year for insurance. So that's $1.2 million that the state of Oregon won't be collecting any taxes on because it's been expensed out. But it seems like the money just would have moved from my brothers and I one pocket into my brothers and I other pocket. We called it insurance when it got over there. Our tax rate in California was about 41% between state and federal taxes. Our tax would have, when we took money back out of the capital, the captive insurance, as dividends, we would pay 15% at the federal level, and we'd still pay 8 or whatever percentage it was, usually about 7% at the state level. So we would have not only hidden the money going in from taxation up to $1.2 million a year, but we also would have reduced the taxation on the money coming out of it. Now, I can see how that would be good for business owners. I can't see how that's good for the constituents that you're here to represent, because you're here to educate kids. You're here to medicate people, and you're here to incarcerate people. That's your primary job, not reducing the amount of taxes that my brother and I might have paid. And so that's where the concerns come from. The other thing is, there are now 30 states that do this. When Vermont became the state that became the new Bahamas and started advertising themselves as the place to tax shelter money doing captive insurance, they got a lot of business, and they now have 570 policies, according to what I read. But we would now be the 30th state doing it. So, yes, there is an advantage to being the first state that does something like when we did single sales factor. We were one of the first states. And for a while, until everybody else is doing it, it advantages us. But it doesn't necessarily advantage us later on when everybody's doing it. And it makes it easier for people to do something that they might not find acceptable. If we had sat with an insurance agent and he had told us this great idea, we'd be listening to it until he told us that we had to go to another state to sign the papers to do this captive insurance thing. And we'd say, why can't we do it here? Well, the law says you have to go to another state. That's what we've read. I don't know that that's totally accurate, because I don't have the experience to do that, but just reading about the captive insurance field made us really raise questions about it. The attached to what you have is a flyer for a conference that goes on for 3 days for people who are in this business to learn about it. And there's just all sorts of complicated looking workshops about how to manage it. And you have the New York Times article that talks about captive insurance. And so I bring this to your attention just because I think it's important to stop and think. This bill is written as an emergency bill, but captive insurance has been around since the 50s in the States. So it's not an emergency. You have to act on now. And I challenge you to read half a page and tell yourself what it said. Because it's kind of like the New Market Tax Credit and the CAPCO bill that seems to be written. So you can't create a flow chart in your mind of how this is working. It talks about what you can't insure, but not about what you can insure. And we found evidence that at the federal level, they've changed some of the rules around what you can't insure for certain businesses. It's used evidently both in estate tax planning and by very large and medium-sized businesses, primarily ones that have an extra $1.2 million a year to shelter from taxation. Thank you.
Thank you, Jody. Questions of Jody?
Thank you very much.
Jeanette, you were shaking your head. Do you want to comment at all?
No. I'm supposed to do that.
I didn't ask you to be for or against the bill. It's just you seem to have a disagreement.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, again, Jeanette Holman from the Insurance Division. We have looked at this, and one of the reasons we didn't want to do the bill in the 2011 session is because these things are complicated. And this bill we have worked to put together to simplify, to take the simplest measures from, or the simplest kinds of captive insurers that we could start with. Captive insurers came into being in the mid-50s, which is a relatively new kind of insurance. A captive insurer is not self-insurance because it's a separate company. A self-insured person or entity essentially creates a fund to pay for its own exposures. A captive insurer is a separate entity, a separate company, and the parent pays a premium to that company. Those premiums have to be actuarially sound, just like any other premium, and that's part of the role of the insurance division, to make sure that the money coming in is sufficient to cover the risk that the company is carrying. They don't have the exposure of a third-party company, but they do have exposure to the the consumers of the parent company. And that's one of the things that people look at, is whether they're paying a high enough premium and setting enough reserves and having investments or whatever to cover risks, not just for, you know, that one company, but to make sure whether I, as a consumer, if I have a claim against the parent company, will be sufficiently covered by their reserves and stuff also. So there's, it is complicated, but it's a risk that the insurance division deals with in regular insurers, but it's got some twists. I'd be glad to answer any other questions.
So it really is a form of self-insurance. It's not just a financial pass-through.
That's correct. And there is an internal, I believe the IRS provision is just like any other kind of expense, that if you're self-insuring, you cannot deduct that as a deduction. But if you're paying a premium, you can deduct it as a business expense.
But you would have to leave that amount of money in there, the actuarially determined amount.
That's
so
correct.
That you, it wouldn't be, you just couldn't put it in and take it out to pay a cheaper rate.
That's correct.
Questions? Jeanette?
Thank you. Greg, you're sitting on the end of your chair. You want to come up and talk?
Gary.
Gary, excuse me, Gary.
My brother's Greg.
I'm sorry, I apologize. I didn't have my glasses on.
I know. I'm Jody Weiser.
Hello, Jody.
And I definitely felt that I wished I had made these conversations happen before this hearing. That's why I didn't sign up. I was like, well, will somebody else raise some of these issues?
Again, Gary Hargis. I'm the proponent of the bill. Jody raised some good questions. The first thing is that you have to, this mechanism is meant to allow a company to expense risk as it happens, rather than, this part I left out, I cut short, rather than wait for the loss to occur. An example, I have two good examples for you. One is standing timber. There is no market to insure standing timber. It's too expensive. Lloyd's doesn't even do it. And so a company with 100,000 acres of standing timber cannot expense the risk until there's the loss. So as soon as they lose $40 million, they can deduct it, but not until then. This part of this was put to bed with the IRS with when Allstate was owned by Sears. Sears bought Allstate. Sears used Allstate to provide them insurance. The IRS objected, and it took many, many years to get through, but the IRS has now thrown in the towel. Sears won that action, and the captive insurance deductibility has been put to bed, to my knowledge. The New York Times article is a very good one, but it is targeted towards other insurance companies starting their own captives to move risk off their balance sheets. And that article talks about insurance companies using this mechanism to do things that are less than transparent. And what this bill does to take care of that is it has an enormous eligibility requirement for an insurance company to start a captive. It has to do with the reinsurance requirement. And in there, the capital has to be $500 million. There's not many that have that much change in their pocket. And so it is a de facto elimination of companies coming to Oregon to start their own insurance companies. I don't want to take much more of your time. Jeanette hit the point. The premiums you charge yourself have to be actuarial. We defend it. The IRS has been more active in making sure that people who do place risk in their captive aren't inflating the premiums. And that enforcement mechanism is in place. I'll answer any other questions.
It sounds like the primary benefits to a company is, one, it allows you to expense your before it happens expense potential things before it happens, and secondly, it probably offers a venue for cheaper insurance.
Yes, and I quickly, the second example is across the street. Willamette University belongs to a captive for their liability insurance. It's called CLIC, College Liability Insurance Captive. And private colleges in Oregon are members, Linfield, Reed, Lewis and Clark, and they had to go to Hawaii to get their captive domicile.
So it's not that we're companies in Oregon are not taking the advantage of the IRS provisions now. They're just having to take that money out of state as opposed to keeping it in state.
And it, Chair Beyer, the short answer is yes. The Oregon companies are going to, rather than take their money to Hawaii and have a Hawaii money manager invest it, we'll keep it here in Oregon and have an Oregon money manager invest it.
Okay. Questions of either of the panelists? Thank you very much. Thank you. Very good material as well. Okay. Anybody else wishes to testify on Senate Bill 1547? Seeing none, we'll close the public hearing. We'll open a work session on Senate Bill 1547. Senator Atkinson.
Move the dash one amendments to Senate Bill 1547.
Senator Atkinson has moved the dash one amendments to Senate Bill 1547. Discussion. Is there any opposition? There is none. Dash ones are adopted. Senator Atkinson.
With a lack in judgment and some frustration, I would move Senate Bill 1547 as amended to Ways and Means.
With the due pass.
With the due pass.
The due pass recommendation. With the in recommendation, we hope it doesn't get stuck there. Amen.
Senator Atkinson has moved Senate Bill 1547 as amended to Ways and Means with a very strong due pass recommendation. Discussion.
Mine was more biblical, actually.
Opposition. Senate Bill 1547 is moved to Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation with no opposition. Close the public hearing. Anything else for the good of the order today? Senators, we have another full agenda at our next meeting, and we'll be bringing back the other three bills for action at that time. We are adjourned.